Nationalism and capitalism. Pedants like to distinguish between patriotism and nationalism. The former signifies love for one's country. The latter, while meaning that too, also means not being particularly tolerant of other countries or cultures. In practice, though, patriots can very easily become nationalists even without knowing it. These are just two points along the same spectrum. What that spectrum is based upon is an emotional attachment to the rather fuzzy concept of national identity. This is supposed to provide a kind of social glue that holds together large-scale, culturally diverse societies and allows them to function reasonably well. Benedict Anderson's seminal work Imagined Communities, 1983, discusses the way print capitalism and the growth of literacy aided the spread of national consciousness. Other factors like improvements in transport and increased mobility also helped to widen the social horizons of what were once relatively isolated communities that characterized a feudal society. Before the rise of capitalism, nation-states did not really exist. Though there are strong grounds for saying that capitalism originated in England, specifically in the English countryside, where the practice of wage labour became universalised, the first prominent individual to put nationalism on the map was arguably a Frenchman, Napoleon. Napoleon explicitly appealed to the idea of the nation as the basis of legitimate political power, where his predecessors had relied instead on such arcane notions as the divine right of kings to govern. However, we should not infer from this that nationalism is the indispensable precondition for a large-scale society to exist. Long before the nation-state existed, large multi-ethnic empires with extremely porous borders existed in the ancient world. In Europe, in 1500, there were approximately 500 more or less autonomous political units, an intricate patchwork ranging from Italian city-states, many of which subsequently fell victim to conquest, to numerous principalities, often themselves the product of dynastic quarrels within aristocratic families, and a scattering of relatively consolidated kingdoms. Some of these were nominally part of one or other much larger ramshackle, sprawling entities, such as the Holy Roman Empire, which, as Voltaire once scornfully remarked, was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. By 1900, however, the political landscape looked very different indeed. The number of self-governing units involved had been drastically whittled down to a mere 20-odd nation-states, having jurisdiction over the entire European landmass. Napoleon's armies, which conquered much of Europe in the early 19th century, contributed to this development in the sense that they helped to create circumstances that eventually led to the rise of nationalist movements later on in that century. Then there is the thorny question of nationalism and cultural diversity. Though it is claimed that nationalism enabled the emergence of large-scale, culturally diverse societies, the fact of the matter is that cultural or ethnic differentiation has often presented a serious challenge to the nationalist project. If anything, the rise of nationalism has brought about the erosion of local cultures and languages, and in general has had a flattening effect on the cultural landscape. What is called the national culture is not always what it seems. In The Invention of Tradition, 1983, edited by Eric Hobsbawm and Terence Ranger, the claim that certain national traditions or institutions have their origins in some mist-enveloped remote past, something that's supposed to invest a tradition with more authenticity, was critically scrutinized and found to be often false. Many of these traditions are pseudo-traditions, only recently invented for the express purpose of trying to fashion a national identity, in more concrete terms, to facilitate a nationalist sentiment. In short, the basic thrust of nationalist ideology tends towards cultural homogenization. The more culturally homogenized a population is, the easier it is for the state to manipulate it and elicit its support. Standardization also enables more effective bureaucratization. Taken to an extreme, this homogenizing thrust can manifest itself in the form of genocide. As Ernest Gellner points out in Nations and Nationalism, 2009, where ethnic pluralism exists, quote, a territorial political unit can only become ethnically homogeneous if it either kills or expels or assimilates all non-nationals. However, one should note that this is only a tendency within nationalist ideology. In the real world, most nationalisms have had to opt for some kind of pragmatic or more inclusive compromise in the form of multiculturalism. Factors curbing nationalism's tendency towards cultural homogenization within the confines of a given nation-state include not only the resilience of ethnic subcultures and the inward migration of, quote, foreigners, bringing with them their own cultural beliefs and practices, but also the impact of what might be called global culture. Back in 1848, the Communist Manifesto had something to say about that. Quote, in place of the old local and national seclusion and self-sufficiency, we have intercourse in every direction, universal interdependence of nations, and as in material, so also in intellectual production. The intellectual creations of individual nations become common property. National one-sidedness and narrow-mindedness become more and more impossible, and from the numerous national or local literatures there arises a world literature, end quote. Big business is today a major purveyor of this global culture. One thinks of the role of big tech companies in providing social media platforms or the impact of global chains like McDonald's in shaping our culinary tastes. Wherever you go in the world, cities are getting more and more alike with the same monotonously predictable selection of high street stores. There is a certain irony in all this. Capitalism, which gave birth to the ideology of nationalism, has also unleashed powerful forces that tend towards the erosion of national distinctiveness. In some ways, this contradiction has brought us to the fraught times we're living in today. The unravelling of the neoliberal project that has been the dominant paradigm since the 1970s has prompted a backlash against globalisation and the resurgence of virulent nationalism. Far-right movements are on the rise in many parts of the world. Their animus is mainly directed at that most emblematic aspect of globalization, the movement of migrants across those imaginary borders that define the capitalist nation-state. Such migrations are often fueled by wars and the devastation inflicted by military action undertaken by the very countries of whose citizens some are now bitterly complaining about the ensuing blowback in the form of desperately impoverished boat people arriving on their shores. It's not just war that is to blame, there's also the economic devastation wrought on people's lives and livelihoods. For instance, the traditional Senegalese fishing industry has been virtually decimated by overfishing and the use of destructive methods like bottom trawling by industrial fleets from Europe and China. This has been a major factor in the increase in Senegalese migrants risking their lives to reach the Canary Islands in the hope of being relocated to mainland Spain.
You've been listening to World Socialist Radio, produced by the Socialist Party of Great Britain. To find out more and to take out a free trial subscription to the Socialist Standard, visit spgb.net/podcast.